Welcome to the session, Architecting Virtual Machine Solutions. In this session, we're going to look at a couple of common virtual machine server workloads that run in Azure. Specifically, we'll look at Windows Server Active Directory workloads, and then we'll look at SQL Server workloads. And we'll look at what are some of the best practices for running these kinds of workloads in Azure. Next, we'll take a look at Azure Backup and finish up by looking at Azure Site Recovery. So let's jump right in and take a look at Server Active Directory in Azure. If you've used Azure in the past, you know that we have Azure Active Directory. So the question then is, you're probably asking, you know, why would you run Server Active Directory in Azure? And that's really what this slide's about. And this really comes down to applications that require Server Active Directory. Server Active Directory and Azure Active Directory are by no means the same thing. So when you're looking at reasons for running Server Active Directory, some of the more common ones are things like just simply migrating existing on-prem application workloads to Azure. So applications that currently have a dependency or require Server Active Directory, NTLM, Kerberos authentication, typical of an on-prem environment. If you wanted to move that workload to Azure, then you probably are also looking at moving Server Active Directory to Azure as well, and then doing some kind of hybrid replication between the on-prem and cloud environment. Another reason why you would run Server Active Directory in Azure is because the workload just simply requires it. So for example, take a look at things like SQL Server Always-On clusters. In order to run that kind of workload in Azure, you will have to run Server Active Directory next to that workload for authentication purposes. DR, or disaster recovery, is another reason. You may, just as part of your DR strategy, want to have Server Active Directory running in the cloud and then have AD replication so that in the event that there's a disaster, you can at least have some directory functionality running in Azure for your applications that are also running in Azure. One of my personal favorites, coming from a developer background, is dev test workloads. If I were developing an application that was going to run in an on-prem environment where I was going to use Server Active Directory for authentication, having a test environment where I could test that application was also often very challenging. Administrators typically aren't going to give you access to the production Server Active Directory, so you have to stand up your own, and that can be challenging in an on-prem environment. But doing so in a Server Active Directory and using some of the ARM templates that are available to create these kinds of workloads, it's actually quite easy to accomplish. It just takes about 15 to 20 minutes to stand up one of those environments, and you're up and running in a dev test environment. And then finally, hybrid is another scenario where you may be looking to run Server Active Directory in Azure. And this is one where, again, you may have applications that are running in Azure that require Server Active Directory functionality. So your on-prem Active Directory becomes your domain of record, as it always has been, but you do some replication to your Server Active Directory workload running in Azure to support those applications in a hybrid environment. So now that we know a little bit about why you might run Server Active Directory in Azure, let's talk about some common configurations. And it really comes down to just a couple of configurations, and those are, one would just be a standalone environment. And what we mean by that is stand up the Server Active Directory, whether it be a single Active Directory a server for dev test scenarios, or maybe it's one's configured for HA, so you have multiple directory servers running in an availability set to support maybe a mission-critical workload in Azure. But in either case, everything is contained in the Azure environment. So in other words, there is a virtual network, there's an availability set, and the Server Active Directory workloads are running within that infrastructure. Now, another one is hybrid scenarios, and that's what I ended on in the previous slide. Here you actually have, for example, a site-to-site or express route connection from your on-prem environment to Azure to support hybrid scenarios. And in this case, you're going to have your Server Active Directory, which will be your primary domain of record, and then you'll have domain replication running between your on-prem environment and your cloud environment. So your replicas will be running in Azure And they're there to support those application workloads that are running in Azure. So let's take a closer look at the replica domain controller scenario. So what you're looking at here on the right-hand side is essentially a graphic out of the Server Active Directory guidance for running this kind of workload in Azure. And so what you see at the bottom there is the on-prem environment, where you have your domain controllers in the on-prem network. And then there's a VPN tunnel connecting or extending that network to Azure, and a virtual network running in Azure. And that VPN tunnel can be site-to-site, or it would be express route. Now, the first thing that you'll notice is we have the domain controllers and the actual applications that are authenticating to those domain controllers in separate availability sets. And again, this is adhering to the best practices guidance for running any workload in Azure. Anytime you have multiple virtual machines running in a common workload, you want to put those virtual machines into an availability set. That gives you the SLA and also improves your resiliency for that workload. Now, at the top are your users that are actually consuming the applications that are running on those application servers. So a typical example here would be, for example, maybe an HR application or some web application, line of business application that the users depend on to do their work. So these application servers are also running in Azure, connected or authenticating to the domain controllers in this environment using traditional NTLM Kerberos authentication against the domain controllers. So another thing to point out here, and this is the last bullet, replication between domain controllers is accomplished using standard AD replication. In other words, what we're saying here is that there's nothing specific or unique to the Azure environment. We're not using any Azure tools or services to do the replication. If you're familiar with Azure Active Directory, you may have heard of things like AD Connect, which is used to connect an on-prem and Server Active Directory to Azure Active Directory. Again, not the same thing. And so we're not talking about that. We're talking about just traditional Server Active Directory replication services between the on-prem environment to those domain controllers that are running in Azure. So some other things that are not necessarily shown on this diagram, but are things that you want to take into account and certainly be thinking about. So for example, if you were to look at this workload, how many storage accounts would you be setting up to support these workloads? The answer to that question is it depends on the workload, and it depends on how many disks are going to be running in that storage account or be persisted to that storage account, because storage accounts have IOP limits. So one thing that you should definitely consider is having a separate storage account for your disk and another storage account for your logging, so that way you're not consuming your IOPS for logging purposes and cutting into that IOP capacity for the actual workload itself. So at a minimum, I would say you want at least two, but again, it comes down to, you know, how many servers, how many disks, those kinds of things are going to determine how many storage accounts you may need. So another thing to consider is load balancers. You know, they're not shown here either, but you can expect that, you know, for example, in the application servers, if all three of those servers were serving up the same application workload, then you'd want some sort of load balancing service in front of that. And so Azure Load Balancing would provide that. You can make those load balancers public or you can make those private. But you definitely want to have some kind of load balancing capability in there as well. Another is, where's the DNS server? So your preferred DNS server location, is it going to run on-prem, or are you leveraging a DNS server in your Azure, in your cloud environment? So those are some other things to take into consideration. And these are all covered in the guidance for running Server Active Directory workloads in Azure. But I just wanted to point out a couple of those as we review the diagram here on the screen. Now we have another scenario where a again, we're running our domain controller or server active directory in Azure, but we also extend this to use Active Directory Federation services. And so there's a couple of reasons why you might do this. The primary one is users, you know, the user or your client wants a single sign-on experience. And really the only way to achieve single sign-on is with ADFS in this kind of configuration. And what that means is that all the authentication is going to happen on-prem. So you notice at the, again, at the very bottom, we have our domain controllers. And whether or not the users are coming in from the public, so at the very top, you know, through the web, or coming from within the organization itself, authentication ultimately is going to happen on-prem. And that's really, that's what we're talking about when we're talking about single sign-on. You may say, well, you know, the applications that are running in Azure are authenticating. And that's true. They're authenticating to the domain controllers. But if you look at what's happening in the ADFS scenario, that authentication is then delegated or federated to the on-prem server. So authentication, the actual token that's issued, is always issued from on-prem. Now, this guidance that you're looking at, or this diagram, again, is straight out of the guidance, and it complies with all the best practices for security and high availability. And once set up, requires the least amount of administration, at least in this configuration. We're showing a Barracuda firewall appliance in between the server Active Directory and the actual web app proxy servers that are running in Azure. And so this actually helps to eliminate some of the additional overhead, you know, things like configuring network ACLs anytime you add a new server to this configuration. Now, it does add some complexity initially setting this environment up, but once it is configured, it does cut down some of that administration. And that's kind of a, that's also reminds me of a good point. If you don't already have ADFS configured in the environment, would you consider doing this for a new deployment? And, you know, the answer is, I guess it always kind of depends on what the requirements are for single sign-on and so forth. But if that's not a requirement, my general answer to that is no. And the reason why is because even though you can mitigate some of the overhead with some of the third-party appliances like Barracuda, for example, you do increase the administration and overhead for this configuration overall. You also increase your security footprint in terms of what do you need to be, what are the risks that you have to make sure you mitigate in an environment like this. So if ADFS isn't already configured and there's not a requirement that forces you to use ADFS, then you probably don't want to go down that path, or at least look closely at it. If ADFS is already present in the environment, then by all means, take advantage of it, because it's going to provide the best user experience. And then you can, as I said, you can augment that with some pretty nice third-party solutions as shown here. All right, so let's just take a look at a server Active Directory configuration running in Azure. Okay, so in this first demo, we're going to take a look at server Active Directory workloads running in Azure. And what I'm showing here is a resource group with several resources in it. This resource group, the workload in this resource group is SQL Server Always On Cluster. I chose this one because that workload does have a server Active Directory requirement. And so kind of leveraging the same resource group and environment for multiple demos. In this one, we'll look specifically at just server Active Directory, though. So the first thing to point out, I'll just show you how the virtual network is defined. If we look in the subnets, you'll see that there's two subnets. We have a static subnet and a SQL subnet. The static subnet is where the server Active Directory virtual machines are actually deployed. So when we look at the addresses that are assigned to these virtual machines, they're going to be in that address range. If we look at connected devices, here you'll actually see the NIC for each one of those server Active Directories that's attached to those server virtual machines. are assigned IP addresses 10.0.0.4 and 5 respectively for the primary and secondary domain controllers. Make a note of those IP addresses because we'll see those in just a second when we look at DNS server configuration. If we go over to DNS servers in the virtual network configuration, you'll notice that we've changed the DNS configuration to custom. And the reason why we do this is because the Azure DNS, the default Azure DNS service provider does not provide functionality that's needed for the native SQL Server always-on cluster. So here we're actually using our domain controllers as DNS servers as well. And you'll notice here that the IP addresses for each one of those, 10.0.0.4 and 5, tie back to our primary and secondary domain controllers. So now let's go take a look at the actual virtual machines. We'll just look at one to look at how the disks are configured. So I'm going to go to the primary domain controller and go down to the disk blade, and you'll see that we have an OS disk as well as a data disk attached to this virtual machine. The data disk actually stores the directory database for Server Active Directory. And again, that's in accordance with the best practices guidance for Server Active Directory on an Azure virtual machine. So if we look at the actual data disk, one thing I want to point out is what the host caching mode is set to. You'll notice it's set to none. This is actually also in accordance with the best practices guidance for running Server Active Directory on an Azure virtual machine. Typically, when you add data disks, as a general rule, you want the host caching mode set to none unless the workload specifically calls out otherwise. So again, I'll defer back to whatever the guidance says, but in this case, for Server Active Directory, the guidance actually is to set that to none. Okay, and then the final thing to point out in this demo is the availability set. So we have two virtual machines that are actually running a common workload, in this case, Server Active Directory. And so when you have two or more VMs in that configuration, in a common configuration, you want to put those into an availability set. And that's what we have right there. So if we were to go drill into that availability set, you'll notice that we see our two virtual machines, the primary as well as the secondary domain controllers running in that availability set. And the reason why we do this is because this gives Azure information about how to deploy our virtual machine workloads. So you can see here that our primary and secondary domain controllers span multiple fault domains as well as update domains. And this is to ensure the highest availability for this particular VM workload. Now, while we're talking about server AD and authentication, it's worth mentioning Linux. Linux servers can be joined to Server Active Directory domains as well. And Linux is by no means a stranger to the Azure platform. There's various flavors of Linux supported, Red Hat, Ubuntu, and so on. However, just to point out a few things, Linux AD authentication, there's basically three main variants that come into play here. And one is, the first one is mentioned here, LDAP authentication. Next would be Kerberos authentication. And then finally, Windbind authentication. Now, there's various things that are going to influence your decision. Some of the things you may take into consideration are things like single sign-on or same sign-on. As you know from the previous discussion, single sign-on means that authentication and token issuance occurs at a single source, maybe on-prem or in the cloud, but it's a single source, versus same sign-on, where you may be using the same username and password, but that's the result of replication that's happening, and your authentication and token issuance is happening at a server other than the server of record or domain of record, which typically is what's running on-prem in a hybrid scenario. Some other things, do you need to support password change capabilities? So self-service capabilities that are common in the enterprise space today. authentication, authorization, file sharing, and even the deployment size and complexity of the maintenance for the environment are things that you want to take into consideration. Now, LDAP authentication and authorization uses the fact that AD is fully LDAP compliant. So applications work with the name service switch, or NSS, and the pluggable authentication module, or PAM, to accomplish this. And they use the LDAP modules to talk to the LDAP endpoint in Server Active Directory. Of course, we always recommend using LDAP-S, or for secure, so that your credentials don't go over the network in an unsecured manner. Now, this does require using a certificate on Active Directory domain controllers, and this certificate must be trusted by the Linux clients. This is best accomplished by adding the certificate authority to your network trusted by both Windows and Linux machines. As noted in the bullet below, with LDAP authentication, users do not have the capability to change their password from the Linux client. So to ensure password safety, you should implement a password change process of some sort that conforms to your password expiration policy. With Kerberos authentication, NSS, or Name Service Switch, still uses LDAP, and it works the same as with the LDAP authentication, but the pluggable authentication module, or PAM, makes use of the PAM Kerberos 5 module to authenticate against the Kerberos Key Distribution Center, or KDC, that's implemented as part of Active Directory. This is actually a pretty popular configuration because it works with out-of-the-box components in a secure way, and it provides password change capabilities, which are often desired in an enterprise environment. Winbind is the more complex solution. It requires a daemon to run the Linux clients. Winbind provides more capabilities at a technical level, such as RPC and NTLM support. However, it does not require any specific components in Windows. Winbind is part of the Samba interoperability suite, which also provides file sharing capabilities using the SMB protocol. So if you plan to use SMB, using Winbind is a logical choice in this scenario. Now, Red Hat has provided guidance on how to implement this scenario, which you can find at the link at the bottom of the screen. In this next demo, we'll take a look at a SUSE Linux VM joined to a Server Active Directory VM running in Azure. Before I get started, though, I want to just show you how this got set up. So once the Linux virtual machine was created, the first thing I did was just sign into the virtual machine using the credentials that I gave Azure when I provisioned the VM. So there you can see the SSH admin user at the IP address of the VM. Next, I went in to enable the root user, so just did that using sudo -s. And then finally, launching the YAS tool, yet another server tool, to get me into eventually the Samba client. Now, I had to install the Samba client, so once you go down to Windows domain settings, you'll install the Samba client. And so what you're looking at there on the right-hand side are the settings inside the Samba client configuration. So it's just a matter of setting a few fields and specifying what your domain or work group is. In this case, it was contoso.com. All right, so back in the portal, here is my resource group that I showed in the last demo. And you can see right here, here is my SUSE VM that I've added to my Server Active Directory domain. In this case, it's contoso.com, actually contoso.local. And if we go look at the virtual network, just to show where this virtual machine exists. Here's the NIC for that Linux VM. You can see it's got an IP address 10.0.0.7. That's the private IP address, of course, for the virtual network. And And so the next thing I'm going to show you is just the machine itself in the Active Directory, Server Active Directory. And so referring back to the slide that I showed just before starting this part of the demo, going through that demo setup, you saw that I went through the Samba client to join the Linux VM2 domain. So to show you the Server Active Directory configuration, here is the virtual machine. This is the primary Active Directory in this configuration. And you can see here's my domain. It's contoso.local. And then here is the VM, the SUSE VM that's included as part of this domain. So the next thing I'm going to do is sign into this Linux VM just using a domain credential just to demonstrate that it truly is connected to the domain. All right, so to sign into this Linux VM using domain credentials, I'm just going to SSH into it. So SSH. And the user this time is going to be a domain admin user. So it's going to be the contoso.local domain and then the admin user. And the public IP address for my machine for this particular instance is this IP. So I'm using that to connect. Normally, you would probably do this over a VPN connection, either site-to-site or express route using private IP, but I'm using public IP for a demo. And the password. So you can see here I'm actually logged in as Contoso admin user on this SUSE VM. And if I do, for example, ID, you can see the various groups, for example, domain users, domain admins, and so on, that this user is a part of. And finally, just another thing we can do here is look at the IP address. So IP address show, and here, look closely here, here's the IP address, 10.0.0.7, which is, again, the private IP address for this Linux VM in the Azure Virtual Network. So I just wanted to verify here that the IP address is the same as what we saw in the portal. All right, so now we're going to shift our focus away from Server Active Directory workloads. We're going to look now at running SQL Server in Azure Virtual Machines. So like we did with Server AD, we'll first talk a little bit about why SQL Server in Azure. So many of the reasons that we already covered with Server Active Directory apply as well. So things like dev test scenarios, hybrid scenarios, legacy application requirements. There's a number of reasons why you would run SQL Server in Azure. Probably one of the biggest ones, though, is the very first bullet, which is the capabilities that you need in, say, SQL Database, which is our SQL PaaS offering, doesn't provide the level of functionality that you may be needing in a SQL Server environment. So if you have an existing line of business application, for example, and there are requirements or features that aren't present in SQL Database, then you would be running SQL Server in that environment, or you'd be making application changes. So there are a few images available in the gallery specifically for SQL Server. So there's 2014, there's 2016 images, and you can use these images to provision your virtual machine instance. And the licensing cost in these images are actually included in the compute cost of the VM. So that's one approach. If you've already got SQL Server running in an on-prem environment and you want to leverage your license, then you could do that by bringing your own image. So you would, in this case, upload a VHD to Azure Blob Storage, and then you would instantiate a virtual machine from that VHD. And then you could use something like License Mobility with Software Assurance to actually transfer that license from your on-prem environment to your SQL Server running in an Azure VM. So some of the bring your own license, bring your own license images that are available are shown here on the right. That's just a screenshot out of the portal. It's not meant to be all the options that are available, but some things to call out in this particular scenario is it does require that you have an EA subscription to take advantage of this. But again, once you've done this, you're paying only for the compute costs. So in other words, your virtual machine compute costs would be the same as a regular VM without SQL Server installed. It'd be the same compute cost. A really nice SQL Server solution template, ARM template, that's available directly from the portal is one that allows you to configure SQL Server always on cluster. I'd like to point this one out because if you've configured this environment in the past, whether it be on-prem or even in the cloud, you know that this is not a trivial configuration. It takes many hours, sometimes days, to set something like this up. And there's actually a template available right here in the portal. It's called SQL Server Always On Cluster. Whereas if you fill in a few parameter settings for that infrastructure environment, within about an hour, 45 minutes to an hour, you'll have that SQL Server Always On Cluster configured, running and ready to go, and in accordance to all the best practices and performance best practices for running that workload in Azure. So this is a huge benefit of the Azure platform and having ARM templates that support these complex workloads. Now, when it comes to performance best practices for running SQL Server on Azure virtual machines, there's a few things to consider here. And again, this is not all of them, but just a few to call out. The full documentation is available at the Vanity URL at the bottom of the screen. But just take a quick look at things like your virtual machine size. You know, the recommendation there is to use at least a DS3 for SQL Enterprise. If you're running SQL Standard or Web, then you could use DS2 or higher. For your storage, if it's a dev test environment, just use locally redundant storage. And that really, for dev test, that applies to any dev test workload. Just use locally redundant storage. There's no point in having geo-replication in a dev test environment. But if you're running in a production environment, you'll want to use premium storage. That is the recommendation, especially for mission-critical workloads, which SQL Server Always On Clusters typically are. For your data disk, assuming you're using premium storage in your production environment, you'll want to have at least two P30 disks, and that would be one disk for your log file and another disk for your data file and tempdb. If you recall from the previous demo, for Server Active Directory, I showed you that the host mode caching was set to none in that configuration. In this one, we're actually recommending that you set it to read caching for your data disk, where your data file is actually hosted. And you want to disable caching on the data disk that's hosting your log file, because all it's doing is just, it's a write-only operation there. Finally, the formatting with documented allocation sizes. So we actually recommend that you format with 64K allocation sizes. If you don't specify that when you initialize the disk, then by default it initializes to 4K allocation units. And then finally, just to call out one other important thing, temporary disks. So disk D drive on the virtual machines, these are meant to be temporary storage. They do not persist from one instance to another, hence the reason why they're temporary. General rule is don't store anything on this disk that you can't tolerate losing. And so therefore, we also make that same claim here for SQL Server best practices. Don't store your log files or your data files on the temporary disk. Now, if you're running DS, DSV2, or GS series VMs, and your tempdb is write intensive, then it's potentially to your advantage to store tempdb on the temporary disk to improve performance. Now, you need to validate that. You need to test it for your workload, but there is a potential for some performance gains in that scenario given these conditions. All right, so now let's take a quick look at a SQL Server workload running on Azure Virtual Machines. All right, so looking at the SQL Server aspects of this demo environment that I've shown in the previous demos. I would start by just taking a look at high level the two virtual machines for the SQL Server cluster, which are SQL Server 0 and SQL Server 1. There is also a file share witness server, which is part of that always on availability group configuration. So that's the third server in this particular scenario. And we'll also notice that there is a SQL availability set. So again, we're putting these VMs into an availability set so that we get high availability and resiliency within the workload. So here you can actually see inside that availability set are two SQL servers as well as the file share witness spread across, again, fault domains and update domains, just like what we saw in the server AD configurations. Now, if we go back and look at the actual SQL server, something that's unique about this particular configuration is the use of a load balancer. So spend just a minute taking a look at this load balancing rule for the SQL Server always on cluster. So this load balancer, the first thing to point out is just, you know, what is the pool of servers that are being, where traffic is being load balanced to? And that's defined here in the backend pool. So if we go look at the backend pool, you'll see that we have two servers in the pool, which is our two SQL servers. And they're at 10.0.1.5 and 1.6 respectively. So that's our backend pool of servers. We could add more to this. So if we added additional SQL servers, we just add those to the pool. And then the load balancing would continue across those additional VMs. There is a front-end IP pool, and this is essentially the internal IP address used for the listener for the load balancer. So you'll notice it's got 10.0.1.9, so traffic coming to that address is then routed to the different back-end servers, 10.0.1.5 or 6, that was shown previously in the backend pool. Now, if we go look at the load balancing rule, here we'll actually see the load balancing rule for this environment. So our front end IP address, which is that 10.0.1.9, is doing load balancing across port 1433 to those two virtual machines in the backend pool. In other words, SQL Server 0 and SQL Server 1. Scroll down a little bit further, you'll notice that we're also making use of a probe. And the probe is there to determine when a machine is healthy or not. And so this is called the SQL Always On Endpoint Probe. So if we go look at that probe, that's over here in the probe blade, what this is doing is a TCP probe. In other words, it's just trying to establish a TCP connection over this port to the various machines that are in the backend pool, so SQL Server 0 and 1, and it will try to probe these machines every 5 seconds, and if it gets two or more unhealthy responses or unable to connect responses from those virtual machines, then it takes that machine out of rotation and marks it as unhealthy. Everything else around this workload is what we saw in the Server AD workload. These were a few things that are unique to this particular workload. So now I'm going to switch over to one of the servers. We'll look at the primary replica of the SQL Server always on cluster. So here you can see I'm in the dashboard for the primary SQL Server in the cluster. And if we look in here, you'll see in our replicas, we have the primary and secondary. So currently SQL Server 0 is primary, SQL Server 1 is secondary. And then you'll notice everything's pretty much healthy as is. We're set up for automatic failover. If we wanted to do a failover, we can just click on the Start Failover Wizard and click through this, and we'll actually execute a failover in this environment. And so you can see the failover took place. We're actually, now it's in the state of resolving. And there you can see SQL Server 0 is back on, noted as the secondary. And so I signed into SQL Server 1 just to show you that the failover did complete. And so now you can see SQL Server 0 is our secondary, and SQL Server 1, which is what I'm currently signed in as, or signed in on, is the primary replica in this cluster. Now, a nice feature of SQL Server that's native to the tool as of SQL Server 2014 is this ability to do a database backup to a URL. And when we say URL specifically, we're talking about a blob container in your Azure storage account. So this can be used whether your SQL Server is running on-prem in a physical on physical hardware or in the cloud running on an Azure virtual machine. It doesn't matter. But the backup itself will go to a storage account in Azure. Now, a couple of things to point out in terms of limitations. There is a 1 terabyte max database size in terms of what you can back up using this feature. If you have something bigger than that, then another option might be to back up to a storage pool where you have multiple disks striped together in a pool. There's other backup options as well. You can do managed backup and so on. But this is one limitation of this feature. You're also not able to do things like append to an existing backup. You know, that's something that's not supported. Now, SQL Server 2016 adds a little bit more functionality to this feature, but these are some of the basic limitations that you want to keep in mind. So let's take a look at how to execute SQL Server backup to a URL using SQL Server 2014. So for this demo, we're going to be backing up to an Azure storage account. And so I went ahead and created a storage account, just a standard storage account. It's a locally redundant storage for the purposes of backup. And so I've created the storage account. I've also created a container. So if I go into the blobs service, you'll see that I've created a container called back. And I just set this as private. So you have to have credentials in order to access this. Any of the blobs that are in this container. So that's all I've set up so far. If you look inside here, there is nothing in the container, but we're about to do a backup to URL and store backup in this container. Now I have a SQL database that has just an AdventureWorks database loaded on it. So we'll use that to demonstrate backing up to a URL. All right, so I'm inside my SQL Server. This is a SQL Server 2014 instance. And as you can see over here on the left-hand side, I've got basically just an AdventureWorks sample database in this instance. Now, in order to do a backup, I have to create a credential for SQL Server. And that's a credential that it can use to authenticate to the Azure Storage Service, the Blob Service in particular. So the first thing I need to do is create that credential. So I'm going to paste in some script to do that. And I'll explain this. So I just had this pre-ready to go, so you don't have to watch me type it in. But this is pretty much stock code. What's different, or what's unique here is a couple of things. One, what do I want the name of my credential to be? So this is just how I'm going to reference that in SQL. So you can call this whatever you want. It's just the identity of the credential. And then the next thing is the name of the storage account you're backing up to. So the storage account I just showed you in the portal was called Contoso Backup. And so therefore that is the identity for this that will be used for this credential. And then the last part, of course, is an access key. It can be a primary or secondary access key, but just go into the storage account and get your access key and paste it in there. And that will give you everything you need to create a credential. So with that script, if I execute this, you'll see the command completed successfully. So that's good news. And if we go look over here in the security tab under credentials, if we refresh this, you'll notice that now we have an Azure credential that we can use for backup purposes. So now that we have a storage account in place, we have a credential on our SQL Server instance, we're ready to do a backup to URL. So to do a backup to URL, we can simply right-click on the database, we'll go to Task, and then go to Backup. And I know this screen's a little hard to read. It's a little small. But what we're going to do is we're going to set the backup to option to do URL. So that's the first setting. And then the next thing is the file name. Now the file name's already, it's set for us based on the name of the database and a timestamp. You can set that to whatever you want, of course. And then the next one is the SQL credential. So what credential are we going to use? Well, in this case, we're going to use the credential we just created. So if I go back into this dialog here, I'll specify, you'll notice Azure credential was a drop-down option. And so before I run this, let me just pull this back up again. So here you can see I selected my Azure credential. The storage container is the back container. Now this container has to already exist. You cannot assume that SQL Server will create that backup or back container. You have to create that ahead of time. And then of course the last part is the URL prefix, and that's going to be unique to your storage account, which in this case on mine is Contoso Backup. Okay, so once we have all that in place, we'll just click OK. And you'll notice it's executing there at the bottom of the screen, and then you'll get a success message saying that the backup was successful. So just to go look at this, if we go back into our portal, and if I refresh the back container, you'll notice that we now have our backup of the database in the back container. So that's how you perform backup to a URL using SQL Server 2014. Now, while we're talking about backup, we might as well go ahead and mention Azure Backup. This is a service that is used to back up an entire virtual machine. And this is not anything that's specific to SQL Server, but since we are talking about backup, I figured we'd mention this here. Now, this is a feature that allows you to back up workloads, whether they're running in Azure on virtual machines, or they can be running on physical servers in your on-prem environment, or they could be running in virtual machines running in your on-prem environment. And of course, as part of this backup service, you can also schedule your backups. You can have your backups run daily, weekly, monthly, and have that data retained for up to 99 years. The backups themselves are actually stored in Azure Storage, as you probably expected, Azure Blob Storage. And this service can also even be integrated with System Center Data Protection Manager. So the steps for setting up Azure Backup, there basically comes down to three main areas. The first is discovery, and that is just simply discovering the virtual machines or the VMs that you want to be included as part of your Azure Backup service. Next, you have to register the virtual machines that you want included as part of the Azure Backup service. This is a one-time activity that you do for each VM. And then the third step or final step involves setting up the backup and retention policy for the virtual machines and schedules. And then once that's in place, Azure Backup will take it from there and perform the backups as you've prescribed. And then finally, just a few things to call out about Azure Backup. Obviously, this is for 64-bit Windows, as well as Windows clients. These have to be local to the region, which means you need at least one vault or backup vault per region. For each of your VMs, you can support up to 16 disks plus the OS disk. So you're looking at roughly, you know, if you had maximum size disk, that'd be 16 plus terabytes per VM. And it does support encrypted disk. And there's a few other things that you can see here as well. Obviously, there's some limits. There are limits with every service in cloud computing. And so make sure you consult what those limits are as you're defining your backup policy. And so our last section in this presentation is about Azure Site Recovery. This is also referred to as ASR. In a lot of documentation, you'll see that acronym. Azure Site Recovery is a service. You can kind of think of this as a DR as a service. And what it does, it helps you implement your business continuity and DR strategy in a way that keeps your applications, the data that those applications rely on, available during planned and unplanned outages. And it also gives you a way to recover those applications and data to normal working conditions as quickly as possible. It is a service that you can use across multiple deployment scenarios. Some of the scenarios that you can apply Azure Site Recovery to are things like just replicating, you know, for example, VMware VMs to Azure Storage or to a secondary data center. You can also replicate physical virtual machines to Azure. Hyper-V, so if you are already running in a Hyper-V environment, you can also replicate those VMs, whether they're running on-prem or in Azure, to Azure Storage. And you can even use Azure Site Recovery as a migration tool to migrate, for example, AWS window instances to Azure virtual machine instances. And as for the types of workloads that this can be applied to, some of the more common ones, things like Active Directory, which we talked about earlier, if you have web applications running on IIS or you have SQL Server instances running, SharePoint farms, SAP, you know, Dynamics, there's a number of workloads, even Oracle, are supported in the application site recovery support matrix. Now, there's others that I didn't mention here, so you'll want to consult the documentation as well as any caveats or limitations that might apply, but it's pretty robust and supports a wide variety of workloads. Now, as you start to onboard the Azure Site Recovery service, there's some tools that are particularly helpful here. The second bullet here is the link to the actual tool. It's called the Azure Site Recovery Capacity Planner. And it gives you a couple of modes for doing capacity planning. There's the first one, which is called Quick Planning. And you can run this tool to kind of get a general idea of what your network and server projections might be based on the number of virtual machines you have, how many disks are attached, what your storage account sizes are, and change rate, and so forth. So that's kind of a quick approach. And then you can also run this in a more detailed planning mode. And this will provide you some details specific to each workload and get down to the actual virtual machine level. So it'll analyze virtual machine compatibility, as well as look at network and server projections for those VMs. So the second link, again, is the link to the tool. The first link here is just a link to explain how to use the tool. So definitely consider taking a look at these as you start to onboard Azure Site Recovery in your environment. So we've reached the end of our session here. And just to summarize what we've covered, we looked at two workloads primarily. We looked at server Active Directory running on Azure Virtual Machines, and we looked at SQL Server always on clusters running on Azure Virtual Machines. So that was the bulk of what we spent our time on in this session. We also took a quick look at some backup strategies, as well as using Azure Site Recovery, or ASR, for not just DR, but also some migration strategies that go along with that. And so with that, this concludes this session. Thank you for watching.